And good evening and welcome to this special one-hour edition of the KRFP Evening Report for November 9th, 2018. I'm Lee Robartis. In the news tonight, we'll have coverage of the Friends of the Clearwater Activist of the Year Award to somebody investigating suction dredge mining on the Salmon River. But first, these headlines. Pullman Police Sergeant Dan Hargraves pled not guilty to first-degree sexual misconduct charges in Whitman County Superior Court today. He will go on trial for the felony January 14th. Hargraves is a 19-year veteran of the Pullman Police Department. The charge is a Class C felony, custodial sexual misconduct. The Lewiston Tribune had reported previously semen stains on a woman's clothing apparently matched DNA taken from Hargraves. Court records say the woman was stumbling along the street and Hargraves gave her a ride to her student housing last year and told her not to leave once she got inside. The police report says the woman left the building and Hargraves picked her up again and threatened to arrest her. The woman alleges she asked what she could do to avoid that and he drove her to somewhere secluded and parked the car where she said she had oral sex with Hargraves and then he let her go. Pullman Police Chief Gary Jenkins said in a press conference when the news broke of the charges, "There's a presumption of innocence until an investigation is complete, but it's hard not to have those feelings given the evidence I've seen. I think the mood of the whole department is disbelief and shock." Jenkins put Hargraves on paid administrative leave. Idaho's Legislative District 5, which is made up of Layton and Benoit counties, will have one Democrat and two Republicans representing it in the legislature for the next 2 years. Republican Bill Gosling of Moscow won against incumbent Democrat Margie Gannon of St. Mary's, who only served less than a month of this year's legislative session after Lieutenant Governor Brad Little appointed her to fill Paulette Jordan's seat in March. Gosling of Moscow got 51% of the vote in Tuesday's election. "I interviewed Gosling this afternoon, but the phone interview recording was defective, so we won't play it on the air. Asked what issue he thinks was key to his election, Gosling replied, education and the need for it to be available to all ages from kindergarten all the way up to those who want to be able to return to school later in life. Asked what the legislature needs to do regarding education funding, Gosling replied, the state constitution clearly says the state needs to provide education and adequate funding for education, and so that's one of the issues I think I'll work on, is to reduce the need for dependence on local levies for education and have the state step up to the plate a little more aggressively as the constitution requires. Asked if teachers are now paid enough after the 5 years teacher salary ladder, Gosling replied, no, I think we still have some ways to go because the surrounding states get to raise their salaries and we'll continue to lose good quality teachers if we don't do something. So again, we have to look at revitalizing the funding model and we need to continue moving forward with additional assistance for our teachers who are asked to do so much for our students, for our teachers today. Asked about the passage of Proposition 2, the Medicaid expansion initiative, and if the legislature has to do anything else on health care besides approving the funding for Idaho's share of Medicaid expansion, Gosling replied, there's a very clear message from the people that they want that gap closed. The legislature is going to have to work very hard to close that gap, but there's a number of other issues that I mentioned in our previous interview, with 27% of our doctors 60 years old or older, we're going to have a major retirement issue, as well as establishing a residency for those doctors that wish to participate or advance their education beyond the base level in specialties such as mental health and surgery. Asked if he had anything to say about the election. Gosling replied, "It was a nail biter. I really appreciate the quality of questions in the contest between myself and Margie. I think we both worked very hard to meet the needs and answer the questions and responded very appropriately to each other's comments. I think that's part of the way we should be doing politics instead of the way sometimes things occur." Spokane officials say despite last month's city ordinance preventing U.S. border agents from questioning people at the Spokane Greyhound bus terminal without permission from the mayor or a court order, Border Patrol agents still question people on board buses and at the intermodal center, which is owned by the city downtown. The ordinance is an attempt to restrict Border Patrol agents who are trying to find illegal immigrants and deport them. Spokane Border Patrol sector spokesperson Bill Kingsford said the agency has not sought permission from the mayor, nor has it changed its boarding practices. Kingsford said the intermodal center is the sole place in the sector where border agents board buses. He said in order to avoid racial profiling accusations, agents now question all passengers when they board a bus. According to the Spokesman Review, Mayor David Condon, who opposed the new ordinance, said city employees have no legal standing to prevent immigration officials from entering city property, such as the Spokane Intermodal Center. City council members, who were in the 5-1 majority that passed the ordinance last month, have said they believe the ordinance will stand up in court if challenged. Kingsford said the Border Patrol has apprehended more than 200 people at the Spokane Greyhound bus station over the past 5 years. He said during the past fiscal year, Spokane Border Patrol sector agents have seized 34 people at the intermodal center. The agency arrested 25 people in 2013, 58 in 2014, 22 in 2015, and 36 in 2016. Kingsford said the number of arrests in the entire Spokane sector has grown faster than intermodal arrests. Last year, Border Patrol agents arrested 208 people across Washington, Idaho, and Montana in the Border Patrol sector. This year, the number was 348. Idaho Division of Financial Management Economic Analysis Bureau said incoming Idaho tax revenues were $34.3 million in the past month, an 11.2% shortfall from projections, which is lower than what economic forecasts expected for October. According to the Associated Press, collections for October were 3.6% under last year's receipts. State forecasters were expecting an 8.6% increase over October 2017 numbers. For the fiscal year to date, the Office of Financial Management says general fund revenues are 3.9% behind forecasts, or about $47.3 million. Individual income tax receipts are driving the shortfalls. Analysts say taxpayers are under withholding because this year's tax cut legislation is leading to significantly lower withholding payments. According to the report, this may present problems for state taxpayers, who could be facing much larger tax bills in April when they file their tax returns. Commercial solar power production at Washington's largest solar farm, located in the Columbia Basin, is set to begin next month. According to Adams County Economic Development Director Stephen McFadden, workers have installed almost 82,000 solar panels near a pioneer-era cemetery in Lind. McFadden said the blue panels move throughout the day, adjusting to the best sun angle. McFadden said, in a really creative way, it's an expansion of our agricultural industry because it's harvesting the sun. According to the Spokesman Review, preheating systems manufacturer Hot Start of Spokane Valley makes devices which keep large engines above 100 degrees for easier starting in cold weather. The company signed an 8-year contract with Avista Power to purchase the power from the Adams Solar Farm. The solar output will allow Hot Start to operate using all renewable energy. Hot Start Chief Executive Officer Terry Judge said they will buy the maximum amount of power allowed by Avista, amounting to 6% of the farm's output, or 1.2 megawatt hours of electricity per year. That's roughly equivalent to Hot Start's annual electric load. Judge said, "We hit the sweet spot on that. We'll be 100% solar." Judge added, "Using renewable energy is a great selling point for customers who prefer products made with all renewable energy." He said renewable energy is, quote, "another way we can make the world a better place. It's cleaner air for our children and grandchildren." STCU Credit Union Facilities and Support Services Director Richard Breitenberg said they also signed an 8-year contract with Avista to purchase solar power from the Lind facility. They will buy enough solar power to offset electrical use at its Liberty Lake headquarters, where data servers that run the electrical financial system are housed. The Lind farm will produce 28 megawatts of power annually, which will make it the state's largest. Innovative Solar Systems of Asheville, North Carolina, has proposed building a larger 40-megawatt solar farm in Adams County, 10 miles northeast of Ritzville. Innovative Solar received a conditional use permit for constructing a 300-acre solar farm. Innovative Solar LLC Land Development Associate Mike Hill said they are working to secure a power purchase contract with Avista. Economic Director McFadden said, quote, "We love the idea. There are other solar companies looking at Adams County." McFadden said the Lind farm will generate roughly $200,000 annually for local taxing districts, with construction hires totaling 150 workers through the summer and fall, giving a temporary economic boost to the region. He said about one quarter of the new hires were local residents. McFadden said these are people who were renting homes in Ritzville and Lind. They were spending their paychecks in our restaurants and stores. McFadden said hydropower has typically been the backbone of energy production in the Northwest. He said we're welcoming solar as another element of renewable energy to Adams County. About 29 people protested outside Republican U.S. Senator Jim Risch's office in Lewiston yesterday in support of Special Justice Department Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of President Trump. According to the Lewiston Tribune, 76-year-old Loretta Anderson of Clarkston initiated the event and promoted it via social media. The event lasted about 45 minutes. Anderson said, "We got awfully cold. I don't think anyone dressed for the cold." Anderson had been vocal in her opposition to President Donald Trump for more than 2 years. She said yesterday, "I've been protesting Trump since the beginning, since before he took office. I signed up for it. I'm old and I can't talk well and I'm half crippled, but it was just something I had to do and I'm glad I did. We got lots of horn honking in our favor and that makes you feel like it was worth it." A representative from Senator Risch's office came out and offered comment submission forms to the protesters, with Anderson saying, "That was very nice of her. She didn't have to do that." You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. The Moscow-based environmental group, the Friends of the Clearwater, presented its Activist of the Year Award to Pat Finnegan Saturday night. Finnegan has worked monitoring suction dredge mining on the Salmon River. Here's FOC Outreach Coordinator Brett Haverstick, followed by Pat Finnegan's acceptance speech at the Friends of the Clearwater annual meeting and banquet on Saturday night.
Friends of the Clearwater and Pat have been working over the years, particularly this past summer, just what I mentioned previously, reining in lawless suction dredge mining on the South Fork of the Clearwater in particular. I wrote here what suction dredge mining is. And so I'll read it, just because not everyone had their hand raised. Speaking of education and outreach. So for those of you that might not be familiar with it, what is suction dredge mining? Well, it kind of sounds like, it is what it sounds like. It really involves vacuuming up the rocks and minerals of a stream bed in the search for gold. You know, I know it's the Wild West, but can we get over, you know, hunting for gold? So after sorting, the rocks and the minerals are then discharged back in the river. Now, suction dredge mining is permitted in different parts of the Clearwater, but the majority occurs on the South Fork. So as you might imagine, as you might already know, suction dredge mining has negative impacts on water quality, macroinvertebrate communities, as well as salmon, steelhead, and bull trout critical habitat. So tonight's award is to honor all the fantastic monitoring work that Pat Finnegan has done over the years on the South Fork of the Clearwater, particularly all the work he did this year. If it's a 30-day suction dredge mining season, Pat might have been on the river 31 days because he really cares. So I'm also happy to share with you that FOC is working with Pat and his son, Kevin. Raise your hand, Kevin. We're working on a short video about the impacts of suction dredge mining. We're really excited about it. The video should be completed this winter. Give it up for Pat Finnegan. You give it to him.
That's a picture of the South Fork Clearwater. Thanks so much, Pat.
Forgive me, I'm new at this. It's okay. You know, I became aware that this was to happen a week, 10 days ago, and my reaction hasn't changed. Is at the time I thought, you know, really, I'm so honored, but I'm not worthy. And I still feel that way, and I have to tell you that I do what comes easy to me, and I live right there. And so as suction dredge mining has kind of unfolded in the last several years, if you've followed the issue, you know that some miners have tried to create out of suction dredge mining a political issue that portrays the public who's against suction dredge mining as being unpatriotic and somehow against the American way of life. And we know better. We know that the patriotic thing is really to care about our natural resources. And so it was easy for me to step out there and say, wait a minute, I don't like what I'm seeing. And I learned pretty quickly that a number of miners were operating without permits, completely unauthorized, and were completely uncooperative with agencies that were responsible for administering mining permits and regulations. So I just stepped in naturally to a situation because I live nearby, and you know, I started looking, taking photos, taking videos, and over the last handful of years, the situation, instead of de-escalating, has escalated. And so I'm asking all of you, and it's with great respect, I don't know where the Clearwater Basin would be without Friends of the Clearwater, truly. I mean, I don't know where I would be in caring about the Clearwater Basin were it not for the Friends of the Clearwater. And so I'm asking all of you to do your best to educate yourselves and to respond where you can. And that's where the really difficult work comes in that I myself fall down on. Is the tough work is when you're sitting there behind your laptop writing those comments and doing the research and trying to make sure that you put the information behind your comments so that people that make a difference take notice of you. And they take notice of the Friends of the Clearwater. They do. And they know that you get the information, and they know Friends of the Clearwater puts it out there. So I'm asking, I'll do what I can. I'll do the easy part. But educate yourself, pay attention, and really keep watching. I think the next 2 to 3 years are going to make a big difference with suction dredge mining. We have a situation with suction dredges where each individual dredge can be operated by really by one person if they know what they're doing. And the impacts can be arguable depending on how much material they move. But if the suction dredgers decide that they're going to operate completely outside the regulations, and if they come with a large enough rig to move enough material, the effect on salmon and trout is significant. And, you know, every one of these streams that they're operating in right now, like Brett mentioned, can adversely affect, in the operation of suction dredge equipment, can adversely affect at least one threatened species, and in some cases, more. In some cases, even endangered species. So, you know, I'm asking you, you know, keep your eyes open, keep your ears open. As this issue comes up and you hear about it more, you know, please be there and write those comments and send them in. That's the toughest thing any of us do, and it's the thing that is going to make the difference. Thank you.
This is a Roger Ingram photo.
That was Pat Finnegan receiving the Activist of the Year Award presented by the Friends of the Clearwater last Saturday night in Moscow. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Tune into Under the Needle, the KEXP Sessions. Exclusive live performances recorded in the shadow of the Space Needle. On the show this week, it's the rockin' garage punk of The Horrors.
Your smile is nothing to live for.
It's one-of-a-kind sessions from your favorite artists and from a few you're about to discover. From the studios of KEXP, it's Under the Needle.
Saturday at 3 p.m. on KRFP 90.3.
KRFP thanks its donors and sponsors, including Hodgins Drug and Hobbies of 307 South Main Street in Moscow. Hodgins features a pharmacy, educational toys, and hobbies. Hodgins also sells and services hearing aids. You can call Hodgins at 208-882-5536.
The Citizens Committee on Legislative Compensation met in Boise yesterday to set pay rates and benefits for lawmakers for the next 2 years. The six-member committee, whose members were appointed by the governor and the Supreme Court, approved a 3% pay raise for legislators next year with a 3% increase in 2020. The committee also reauthorized the existing medical and dental package that legislators receive with incremental increases in per diem rates, leadership pay, and other expense categories. The committee's most notable action was the repeal of the retirement benefit. This benefit applies primarily to longtime legislators who subsequently become agency directors or are appointed to high-paying state jobs. In those cases, their years in the legislature count as full-time service when calculating retirement pay. Lawmakers are considered part-time state employees, except in that regard. All other part-time employees who shift to full-time work would have their retirement prorated. For legislators, the perk can boost retirement payments by as much as $3,000 per month once they leave state service. Committee member Dennis Johnson, who is United Heritage Insurance president and CEO, said, "This question of the enhanced pension benefit has been around a long time and someone needs to deal with it." Republican House Speaker Scott Bedke of Oakley and Republican Senate President Pro Tem Brent Hill of Rexburg recommended the Citizens Committee remove the retirement benefit. There was some discussion about whether the committee had the authority to do that and whether the legislature could overturn it if they did, with the committee ultimately moving forward. The legislature itself had tried to eliminate the perk in 2015, with the bill passing the House 38 to 30. 32, but failing to advance in the Senate. Johnson went on to argue the change should not take effect immediately. He said the perk has been in place since 1990, so it may have been a factor in someone's decision to run for office or to run for re-election. Johnson said, in all fairness, I think we need to grandfather in current legislators. The committee had agreed to eliminate the benefit effective July 1st, 2019, with anyone elected prior to that, including those elected this week, still being eligible for it. The committee also approved the following actions: an increase in per diem rates lawmakers received during a legislative session from $129 to $139 for those with a primary residence 50 miles or more from the capital in Boise. Those who live within 50 miles will receive the federal reimbursement rate. A boost in House Speaker and Senate President pro tem pay from $4,000 to $5,000, which they receive in addition to their base legislator salary. A $2,000 pay differential was also approved for majority and minority leaders in both chambers. Approval of a new unvouchered expense payment of $200 per 1,000 square miles to compensate lawmakers for a portion of the expense incurred while traveling in their districts if their districts are extremely large. Clarification that the airfare reimbursement rate lawmakers receive for flying to and from Boise is capped at the economy class rate. The 3% increase in pay will increase salaries for lawmakers by $521 next year to a base salary of $17,879. That leaves Idaho well below the national average, with Washington state lawmakers having base salaries of $48,731 by comparison. According to the state constitution, the legislature can only reject or reduce an increase in compensation that's authorized by the committee. Middleton school staff who wore controversial Halloween costumes will be reinstated. The Middleton School District announced in a news release it will, quote, welcome our teachers and aides back into their classrooms in the next few days. The district said it completed an internal investigation involving staff at Middleton Heights School who wore the costumes depicting a border wall and stereotyped Mexicans. In a statement released Wednesday, Middleton School District Superintendent Josh Middleton said, "We embrace this opportunity for continuous improvement and striving toward becoming the district we want to be with the outstanding educators we have." The statement went on to say, an interim principal will be retained in place of Principal Kim Atkinson in the meantime. Middleton School staff involved with the costumes released a statement saying, as educators, we understand our responsibility to our students, our parents, our colleagues, our community, and to our profession. While there is no malice or ill will in our intentions, we recently came up short in our understanding of the awareness of the impact of the choices we made. Regardless of our intent, individually and collectively, we are taking and will continue to take steps to learn, grow, and better understand and embrace cultural differences. The statement went on to say, we remain absolutely committed to ensuring that our students, who we care so deeply about, have a safe and secure learning environment and that values all individuals and embraces different backgrounds and points of view. We apologize for our actions and the message conveyed, and we commit to using this as a starting point for a higher level of growth and understanding. Last Friday, the Idaho Statesman published pictures of staff members wearing Halloween costumes that portrayed the border wall reading Make America Great Again and Mexicans that had been found on the school district's Facebook page and were quickly going viral. Superintendent Middleton posted a video response on Facebook the morning of Friday, November 2nd, following the online uproar. On Saturday, November 3rd, Middleton announced the 14 staff members involved, including Principal Atkinson, had been placed on administrative leave. A petition to reinstate the staffers and principal was posted on change.org Sunday, and it eventually received 17,122 signatures. Wednesday's statement went on to say, "It is important to note that after the district's review, it has been validated that there is nothing more than love and commitment in the hearts of these teachers and aides. The educators involved chose the profession to work and educate all students, and we are confident in their abilities to provide an effective learning environment for every student in the building." The trial of a Nez Perce man accused of shaking his infant daughter to death will start in Lewiston Tuesday. Court officials moved the trial of 28-year-old Daniel Aldrin of Lewiston after Clearwater County failed to seat an unbiased jury. Aldrin is charged with the May 15, 2016 murder of his 28-day-old daughter, Cassandra Lynn Aldrin. Autopsy results show Cassandra died of multiple organ failure resulting from blunt force trauma involving internal injuries and bruising to her body, injuries consistent with being shaken or beaten, and not consistent with accidental injury. Doctors trying to treat the infant also found many separate bruises as well as what appeared to be grab marks on the infant's leg. Aldrin's former wife, Serenity Grandstaff, dropped off the baby and a two-year-old with Aldrin May 11, 2016, and when she returned, she found Aldrin holding Cassandra, who was blue, cold, and unresponsive. Aldrin claimed he had gone into the kitchen for a moment and returned to find a 3-foot-tall speaker next to Cassandra, believing it had fallen on top of her. The infant was taken to a Spokane hospital where she later died. Police arrested Aldrin months later after investigation by the Clearwater County Sheriff's Office, which included putting together mock reenactments of the force a speaker could cause from falling. Police also examined multiple phone, text, and Facebook messages as evidence in the case. Second District Judge Gregory Fitzmaurice decided several aspects of the case will be withheld from the jury and not introduced at the trial, including Aldrin's other pending charges, which are felon in possession of a firearm, possession of a controlled substance, injury to a jail, and allegations that he had sex with one of his jailers. Aldrin is accused of having a romantic relationship with former Lewis County Detention Deputy Amanda Morris, who was sentenced to 2 years probation for the charge of giving alcohol and cigarettes to Aldrin. Her charge of sexual contact with an adult inmate was dismissed as part of the plea agreement. Judge Fitzmaurice also ordered Aldrin's suicide attempt while incarcerated not be mentioned at the trial. According to Serenity Grandstaff, Aldrin threatened suicide in the weeks following Cassandra's death and attempted suicide in March, just months before his trial was to begin in Orofino. Aldrin also allegedly repeatedly beat Grandstaff, evidence that will likely prompt an objection if raised. Police found a tub filled with about 2 inches of water and a diaper at Aldrin's home the night of the incident. They also found a T-shirt and an oral medical syringe. Grandstaff also told investigators she remembered seeing water in the tub and that the baby was wet. The trial is expected to last 3 to 4 weeks because of the numerous experts and others who will be called to testify. Attorney James Seabee of Moscow is representing Aldrin, while Clearwater County Deputy Prosecutor Lori Hood Gilmore is representing the state. First District Judge Fred Gibler will preside over the case, as Judge Fitzmaurice will not be available for the trial. Artists and supporters of the American Civil Liberties Union of Idaho are celebrating at the Garden Lounge at this hour due to the completion of a 4-story-tall mural painted on the north side of the Moscow Hotel this fall. The mural was painted after Carly Lilly and George Scandalos purchased the building. and contacted the ACLU of Idaho, which is commissioning several murals around the state in honor of their 25th anniversary. KRFP reporter Al Chittister spoke to people at the event.
Hey, this is Al Chittister for KRFP, and we're talking with Tyler Palmer from the city of Moscow about the mural that's going to be on the Moscow Hotel. So tell us.
Yeah, you know, this is something that Moscow's heart of the arts, and public art is a massively important component of what we do here. I think that one of the things that people love about Moscow is that for being a small town, it's packed with culture. And, you know, culture, cities exist because people want to live close to one another. That's why cities exist. That's why we, you know, and cities are responsible for practical things. We have to provide infrastructure, roads, water service, water lines, sewer lines, all of these practical necessity things. But one of the things that we really try and recognize and support as a city is that we realize that it's not just the utility things. It's not the base necessity things that make us happy. It's those meaningful interactions with other people. It's beauty, it's art, it's music, it's culture. And so the city really takes that seriously and tries to promote cultural events here in Moscow. And so when the ACLU selected Moscow as one of the locations for a mural, and George and Carly, the owners of the Moscow Hotel, the new owners of the Moscow Hotel building, were gracious enough to offer up a big wall space, we tried to do what we could to help support this because, you know, murals are beautiful. People love public art, and so this was a really nice public art installation. And so, you know, in a lot of different ways, the city supported, including helping with traffic control and permitting, with that sort of support. And then there was a solicitation from the council for some art funds for some private support. So anyway, it's something that we're really excited about. We think it's cool that Moscow had the opportunity to be one of the three cities in the state that was selected to do this.
Well, you add that to the public art that's on all those utility boxes around here, and it looks like a pretty arty place. Now, I recall a couple of years ago there was talk of like changing the motto of the city, but I think this is a move in the right direction to flesh out the motto of the city.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that a lot of things evolve and people look at different things, but I think one of the things that people appreciate about Moscow is that we have all the great things of small town Americana. You know your neighbors. You walk down the street and you know people. A lot of people don't feel like they need to lock their doors. It's a very safe place. But some of the things that in a community this size are often lacking are those like very nice cultural things that we have. And you know, art has such a broad definition. Art can mean a lot of different things. It's not just necessarily strictly painting and sculpture. And I think in Moscow we embrace that. I remember a couple years ago I had some friends visiting and we were sitting out on the patio at Myelina, and there was a group of dancers from the University of Idaho who came down the street all dressed in white doing kind of an interpretive dance. And the people that were visiting us stopped and they just stared. And Meg and I, we looked and we appreciated it and we just kept eating. And they looked, our friends looked back at us and they said, "Are you seeing this?" Because we just weren't flabbergasted by this going on. And we said, "Well, yeah." And they said, "Is this normal?" And we said, "Kinda, yeah." That's just, you know, we have wonderful buskers at the farmer's market. There's neat artistic things going on. So I think that, you know, Heart of the Arts is a nice thing about Moscow. It encapsulates a lot of what we do and what we try to be.
It makes us more than just another downtown.
Yeah, you're darn right it does. And Moscow is the heart of the downtown. It's just the heart of what we do as a community. Those gathering places where we can come together and we can be together. That's why cities exist. It exists so that we don't live in these bubbles and we get to interact and meet new people and be involved in each other's lives and support one another. And, you know, it's largely the message of this mural, the ACLU mural, is that togetherness and that there's power in unity. And that's something that I think is a really powerful message for all the residents of Moscow.
All right. Thank you, Tyler Palmer. Al Chittister here with Carly Lilly. I understand you now own this building.
I do. Yeah, we bought the hotel in August of this year.
Okay.
So we had aspirations of moving Sangria downtown for quite a while, and this building came up for sale, and we thought this would be a perfect home for Sangria. And I've always loved this building. It's an iconic Moscow building with so much history. So we're really excited to be the new owners.
Well, tell us about this mural project.
Well, the mural project is very exciting because it's really the sort of the first of its kind in Moscow, a mural on the scale that this mural is. It's 40 feet wide by 55 feet tall. And it's to commemorate the 25th year anniversary of the ACLU in the state of Idaho. So there were three projects around the state, and Idaho Falls got one, Garden City near Boise got one, and Moscow got one. The other projects are smaller format. Their budget was $3,000, and I knew the project coordinator for the special projects coordinator for the ACLU and just happenstance ran into him, and he was meeting with some people from the arts department, and this mural project was in the works. And I said, you know, we bought the hotel. At some point in the future, we should do a mural on the building. Like, you should put, we would be happy to offer this space in the future for a project. And he said, well, show me the wall. And so we walked around to the parking lot, and I said, I think it would just be an amazing way to light up this parking lot, and it's such an urban environment with brick on three sides. So he said, well, we should just do this now. And I said, well, how much would it cost to do a project of this size? And he said, it would probably be about $20,000 to $22,000. Do you think we can raise the money? And I said, you know, I think Moscow is an amazing community. Why not? And so we did, and it was an incredibly accelerated timeline, and we just put the word out to all the people who we thought would want to be a part of a piece of public art, and everybody came out of the woodwork and made it happen. Businesses donated in-kind donations. We got private donations from individuals in the community. We had groups coordinate with each other to accept donations or sort of facilitate the project in whatever way they could. So we put out a request for proposal. We got many submissions. We narrowed it down to 5 finalists. We paid them a stipend to generate some imagery for us. Then we formed a subcommittee that was really kind of cool because the U of I Law School was represented, the Human Rights Commission of Moscow was represented, the Arts Department, the Arts Commission, the ACLU, us as the building owners, the Pritchard Art Gallery. So there were all these really great people putting their heads together to evaluate these submissions, and the choice was unanimous. The piece of art that made it onto the building was a unanimous vote among the table. So that was really cool. We expected to be deliberating and hashing it out why this one was better, why that one was better, and it was unanimous. And so we said, let's pull the trigger, let's do it.
So a lot of folks participated in this project in choosing it and getting it, and the financial contributions as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, we really involved the population, and we talk about public art. It was truly public art process. Like we involved so many different entities. The county was involved. The city of Moscow was involved. So it's been a really great experience. I feel very proud to have the image that was chosen by the subcommittee on the building, and proud to be a part of the community. And we call ourselves the heart of the arts, but it's neat to be a part of the process that proves that we are that thing. So, yeah, it's neat.
So you have a ventricle right here. Thank you, Carly Lilly.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay. We're talking to Leo Morales. You're from the ACLU?
Executive Director of the ACLU.
Okay, based out of where?
Boise.
Boise, okay.
That's right.
So how did this project start?
Well, at the beginning of the year, so first of all, this year is the ACLU of Idaho's 25th year anniversary of being part of the national ACLU. So as a staff, we came together and we thought, do we do one event or do we do something different? And our staff thought, why don't we do something different? And the idea of the mural came about. And so we hired a project manager and selected different cities across the state, and Moscow was one of those cities. And so that's how this particular mural came about. The idea of actually doing murals that would honor the history, the mission, and the work of the ACLU in combination with the local community as well. So there's the entire, the beautiful part about Moscow, I would say the beautiful part about Moscow is that the entire community came together. Many leaders came together to actually make this particular mural happen, and it's large, and it's amazing of the scale of this particular project, and that's, I would say, because the community came together to make it happen.
Well, this is an arts community, the slogan being Heart of the Arts. So, I suppose we feel honored to be chosen over Coeur d'Alene or Sandpoint, you know, which are two other places not too far away.
Exactly, not too far away, but the Moscow community really came together, and some of the local leaders, essentially said this is a place that we want to be involved in, and they are the ones that really made it happen.
So. Well, good. Thank you, Leo Morales.
No,
appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're here with Nancy Cheney. What do you know about this project?
Well, my husband and I are supporters of the ACLU mural project, and George Skandalos and Carly Lilly have taken it upon themselves to sort of exaggerate the scale of this thing from the way it was originally intended. We're so fortunate to see this demonstration of civil liberties in our community.
Civil liberties written large on the walls of Moscow.
Exactly right, Al.
Very appropriate. Thank you.
There you go.
And we're here with Karen Rohn, who is the artist chosen for this mural project. Tell us about that, about your concept.
Well, it was a concept between myself and Shoga Ota, who is my son-in-law, but also an artist designer over in the Seattle area. Mm-hmm. And basically, we, you know, look through the ACLU's website, and came across with a feeling that it was about unity and unity of people regardless of what the issue or subject matter may be. And that's where we came up with the hands up. It could be hands up in happiness, hands up in many, many things.
Were you inspired by anything you saw in Seattle? Seattle's got a lot of very good murals.
Yeah, Seattle has a lot of awesome murals. We actually designed this long distance. He worked in Seattle, I worked in Potlatch where I live, threw ideas back at each other, and basically we knew whatever our idea was going to be, it was about people being able to have a voice regardless of who they were. And in a positive manner, how we can all come together and fight for those voices.
Yeah, rights apply to everyone, no matter what your status is.
That's right, yeah. That's right.
Thank you, Karen.
You bet, thank you.
That was artist Karen Rohn, and she was the person who painted the 4-story tall mural on the north side of the Moscow Hotel this fall, after Carly Lilly and George Skandalos purchased the building. Those were interviews at the celebration of the American Civil Liberties Union mural. They were recorded at the Garden Lounge just during the last hour. We now turn to our final segment, a report on the Moscow Tree Commission given by Commission Chair Clark Philip at Monday night's Moscow City Council meeting.
Just like any other aspect of our public infrastructure, our public schools, our roads and streets, the community forests should be thought about as an integral part of our green infrastructure, consisting of privately owned trees, trees in the rights of way, and also trees on public property. Benefits of these trees include cleaning and cooling of the air, especially during our endemic summer wildfires, and traffic calming measures, producing a boxed-in effect that forces drivers through a psychological means to think that they're boxed in and slow down on our city streets, reducing energy demand during the summer months by shading our homes and breaking the wind during the winter months, conserving water by shading water-loving turf. And I'd also like to point out that when you plant a tree with turf underneath and remove some turf, it may qualify under our city water program's turf removal rebate program. It's a mouthful. It, of course, enhances our public space with our parks and our local university. It may help our wildlife too much with the recent arrival of a bull moose in my neighborhood, coincidentally. And, of course, maybe the most observable benefit that trees is our economic stance in our public businesses downtown and throughout the city, with our multiple eateries that we see in people enjoying underneath our trees in the summer months. And of course, our citizens can increase in their property value if they plant ornamental or shade trees in their property. As a part of the city's comprehensive plan, trees have been added to the plan and also are helping climate change mitigation through the increase of forest diversity as pests and tree pathogens inevitably move their way north into our area. Reducing the heat island effect with shade being cast onto our asphalt surfaces instead of direct sun, which prolongs the life of our paved surfaces. Stormwater mitigation through the slowing and cleaning of stormwater in our riparian areas and also our tree islands and parking lots. I want to see increased tree planting on our public lands here in the city and on the rights of way. Enforcement of our tree removal and replanting permitting process through Parks and Rec. Planning for the replacement of our downtown trees to keep that vibrant economic basis going. Keep planting those trees along our city pathways and our active alternative transportation methods. Keep people out there biking and walking to school. But also planning for shade where it's not wanted, such as where alternative energy, solar energy, can be used. So these are all parts of planning for the city's comprehensive plan where trees come into play. Public outreach, maybe we might consider unofficially our capstone event is Arbor Day each year. This year was at Lena Whitmore Elementary School where a oak tree was planted. This is a recycled picture, but as you can imagine, there were still multiple children with tools several times their sights being swung around and almost hitting other children in the head with adults looking on. We are also presented with the Quarter Century Tree City USA Award and the Growth Award, which has been awarded for several years in a row now. Of course, Mr. Mayor, you were there on that beautiful sunny April day. Yep. To give the annual proclamation. Thank you.
And you usually have a 50-50 chance of the weather in April, guys.
And I think I got a sunburn, so we had the good weather. Other public outreach events include our annual farmers market booth manning. This year we were at the very first farmers market in May, where all 350 of our seedlings went out to the public in one, well, I don't know how many hours they went, but they went quickly. We had none left over. We also talked tree planting and selection with regards to our revised and new revision to our street tree selection and planting guide. Our September booth consisted of talking about downtown street tree replacement ideas, our various literature pamphlets that were distributed, and also speaking about the Food Forest Park, which I'll get into more. Classes offered this year included our perennial fruit tree pruning classes given by the fantastic Deb Pearson of WSU. Tim Story was kind enough to let some of the students butcher some of his own trees at his orchard between here and Potlatch. David Griffith gave a landscaping class just recently in September. And again, Mr. Tim Story at his orchard gave an heirloom apple tasting event just a couple weeks ago. Issues strongly considered by the Tree Commission this year. We focused on planning for the downtown street tree replacement, putting out quality tree classes and developing new ones, but of course the Food Forest Park was on everybody's mind quite a bit. Goals of the Food Forest Park this year, after the acquisition of the 4-acre piece of land near the Grove Apartments in Indian Hills, were to establish a core development team consisting of two Moscow Tree Commission members, one of the Parks and Rec Commission, one member from there, a member of the public, this in this case the executive director of Rural Roots, to be on the core development team, and a locally recognized expert, which in this case we couldn't think of anyone else but David Griffith, who departed once he kind of received this position. Goals of the Food Forest Park development included, for one, naming the park. Right now the working name is Food Forest Park. But we are in the process as we speak, and tomorrow we may hear some of the proposed names to officially name the park. Other goals, create a shared understanding of the project with a mind mapping exercise, which occurred with the core development team recently. If you picture a crab with 8 legs, this mind mapping project looked like a crab with about 50 legs. So there's a lot of aspects of this park that are very, very exciting. Future goals are assign work projects that are both measurable and achievable, develop a scope of services for a project consultant, and identify stakeholders for a communication plan, how we're going to eventually glean from this Food Forest Park. There's still a lot of questions there. Ultimately, by February 5th, 2019, there should be a conceptual plan that will be drafted along with a cost estimate provided by the consultant, which will be included for consideration for the fiscal year 2020 budget. As always, there's works in progress. The Food Forest, of course, is going to be a legacy program, and the planning is, like I said, very important and ongoing. We want to increase trees where they can be planted in our rights of way, where they make sense, where they're not under wires. We want to promote education about the enforcement of tree removal and planting and the permitting process, and with the overall goal, again, to increase the total number of trees in our community forest. And with that, that concludes the annual report to the commission or to the council. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to field them.
Clark, I got a question for you. You had mentioned earlier in your presentation about if somebody plants a tree and replaces some sod, where that tree's going to go. There's a kind of a rebate. Did I misunderstand that, or is that, could you explain?
So the city water department, as far as I understand, still offers a rebate program where if you remove turf, there is a rebate program out there for whatever replaces that turf. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Mayor Lambert. Nicole Baker with the City of Moscow has the Y-scape program that if you remove some turf and do Y-scaping, there's an opportunity to have some funding available for that.
Oh, that part I understood. I thought maybe there was something that if you took some sod out, you could get a tree in lieu of taking that sod out or something like that.
Rebate could help pay for the trees.
Sure. And I'll have to talk to Nicole about it because I'm not sure exactly how much of a square footage or area that she would be talking about there. So I just thought I'd bring that up. Questions for Clark or David? Gina?
Would you tell us about your street tree guide? I have to really think slowly and enunciate. Street tree guide.
The revised street tree guide, I'm not sure when the last revision came out. However, the trees that are in the book were revised for drought tolerance, cultivars that are suited for our area. There is also some icons kind of put in that into the street tree guide, which kind of catch people's eye for are they favorable for planting under power lines so they only reach a certain height? Do they attract pollinators, or they attract birds? They are organized a little bit better this time by height and size. And I can't remember now if there's information for local sources. However, we are trying to kind of proof are what's in the street tree guide with what's available from our local nurseries.
That was Moscow Tree Commission Chair Clark Philip speaking at Monday night's Moscow City Council meeting. You also heard briefly from Mayor Bill Lambert and City Council Member Gina Taruscio in that clip. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Saturday weather, mostly sunny, high 42. Patchy fog tonight, otherwise partly cloudy, low 23. Sunday, patchy fog before 9 a.m., otherwise mostly sunny, high 41. partly cloudy Sunday night, low 21, mostly sunny Monday, high 43. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events, and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach and Kurt Morrison assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a good night. KRFP Moscow Pullman Community Radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com.
Tired of your wardrobe? Doesn't fit? Need something new for the holidays? Hate shopping? You're in luck. KRFP is having a community clothing exchange Saturday, November 10th from 6 to 8 at the Attic, 314 East 2nd Street. Bring your unwanted clean clothes on Saturday to the Attic. Throw your old clothes in the pile. Pick out new to you clothes. As simple as that. No shopping, no money. You get new clothes, a clean closet, and a fun time. And we'll cart the old clothes to Sojourner Truth Alliance House. Remember, 6 to 8, Saturday, November 10th, at the Attic. Drop-offs at the party only, please. See you there.